Hold on to your butt.
Da-da-da. Oh, hello. Welcome to episode 124 of the Civil War Breakfast Club podcast. As always, I'm joined by Mary, a Canadian leprechaun whose rainbow always leads you to a pot of golden IPAs. I am merely a soggy bowl of Lucky Charms named Darren. Daya Gwit, Mary, to everybody who's celebrating St. Patrick's Day. How are you doing today?
I should be able to speak Irish considering I'm three quarters Irish, but I have no idea what you just said. But I did love Lucky Charms as a child to the point where...
Who doesn't like Lucky Charms? Well, I believe Daya Gwit is greeting. Who knows?
They got Gaelic. Banned from my house because all I would do is I would eat the marshmallows and leave the cereal. Mm-hmm. So that my mom was like, this is waste of money, no more.
Not surprised anyway. All right. So what's going on with you? It's been a couple of weeks since you recorded. Very excited to get back on this Irish holiday here in Boston. We're looking forward to all that stuff. So before we get started, I am always a gracious host. So I will ask you, but of course, what are you drinking today, Mary?
I am drinking Liquid Vacation Tropical IPA from Lord Hobo, which is a local brewery here. And I'm drinking it out of my Sarah Edmonds mug because I know we're doing an Irish episode about the Irish Brigade today, but we're also recording on Women's Day. And she is one of my, she was a, disguised herself as a soldier in the Civil War. She was, did a bit of spying and she was also a nurse. So I just wanted to have her as my mug for this episode.
Oh, good. Good. Well, that's very well. Before we go, happy International Women's Day to you, Mary, and to everybody who listens. There's a lot of great females out there who do history, and sometimes at their own disregard and fortune, social media. Mm-hmm. But you are all doing great work. So congratulations to everybody who does that, and to everybody International Women's Day. That being said, Mary, you got something to ask me, don't you?
What are you drinking?
Oh my God! Thank you so much. It is. I do have the luck of the Irish today. Obviously, I am drinking 617 Lord Hobo Hazy IPA. 617, of course, is the area code for Boston. We're going to talk about Boston a little bit tonight, and I am not drinking out of a coffee mug, Mary. I'm drinking out of my Irish Brigade beer glass because although I'm not drinking Guinness or anything Irish, it's not St. Paddy's Day just yet.
No,
I must represent because that episode today, Mary, we are going to be talking about the Irish Brigade with the Feast of St. Patrick just a few days away. What a great opportunity to discuss one of the most significant and hardest fighting units in the entire American Civil War. That is, of course, the Irish Brigade. Now, from the war's beginning right through Appomattox, 7,715 Irishmen from New York, Boston, even Philadelphia, carrying their green regimental flag, they fought to the death for a flag that wasn't even their own. We're going to talk about that. And to understand what, you know, who they were and why they fought, it's really important to understand the plight of the Irish in the mid-1800s, a time when they were anything but lucky. See what I did there, nice. Right?
Yeah, they were very much like, so the majority of Irish immigrants that came to the United States, they had very little money, if at all, education, jobs, because a lot of them, when they came from Ireland, had been tenant farmers, and that was the same thing that they did here. But a lot of them did settle in cities, and the jobs were low paying, living conditions were not great, and already settled here U.S. citizens that have been here for generation upon generation did not like them very much.
And that's the thing, you know, you got to look at their history a little bit. From 1845 to the mid-1850s, the potato crop in Ireland became infested with fungus, causing 75% of the Irish potato crop to fail, leading to widespread starvation in the rural parts of Ireland. Now, despite this failing potato crop, Ireland was still a huge supplier of food to England, who still naturally demanded the food from the Irish. So despite the fact that many within its country, you know, were starving to death, they still had to send the food to the empire, which, as you can imagine, did not go so well. This will be known as the Great Famine, and it resulted in over 1 million Irish leaving their home country and emigrating here to the United States, mostly to the northeastern cities such as Boston, New York City, and Philadelphia, right? Now, like you said, most of these Irish immigrants came from rural areas. Mm-hmm. And once they got to the United States, they had limited skills in the new world of industry that was here. So to make ends meet, they took jobs, like you said, as laborers, dock workers, basically any type of physical labor they could get,
yeah,
they tried to get.
Digging ditches, think of like the jobs that nobody wants to do. That's what the Irish were doing when they emigrated over here.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about dock workers, digging ditches, playing hockey with the Maple Leafs, all the jobs that nobody wants, right?
Nobody but wants to do that today.
No, but these ones they have to do. But when you look at the influx of population, in 1860, Boston's population was 26% Irish. Mm-hmm. New York's was 25% Irish. Philly was 18% Irish. Even today, Mary, there are more people in the city of Boston of Irish descent than Ireland. That's how Irish, how green Boston is.
That's crazy.
In Chicago, they make the river green to pretend they're Irish. In Boston, we're just Irish.
I was going to say,
okay.
The one thing that I was thinking about when I was researching for this episode was the movie Gangs in New York, which we obviously touched on in our episode about the draft riots. But that touches on how the Irish were treated at the time. And I think Bill the Butcher, the guy that he's based off of, or at least in the movie, that is part of like the Know Nothing political movement, the nativist movement that was happening in the U.S. at the time, that there's this influx of Irish immigrants because of the famine. But these nativists, they spread rumors about the Irish, including that there were dungeons under St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. And that they were an advance guard of this papal invasion that was going to happen. Now, specifically within the Irish, like you have, the Irish Protestants, but you also have the Irish Catholics. The Irish Catholics were probably the most hated of the Irish.
Exactly. And I don't know if you know this, Mary, but many in this country aren't very welcoming to foreigners to this soil. In 1860, that anti-Catholic Irish Catholic sentiment you mentioned was extremely strong. No Irish need apply. That was a very popular sign with companies looking to hire, as these Irish flooded these northern cities in seeking of work because of what was going on in their home country. Now, this growing xenophobia in the north led to the creation of the Protestant Know Nothing Party, whose major focus was anti-immigration, and they targeted the Irish because of their allegiance to the Pope, right? So this large influx of Irish who tended to look after each other, I mean, they're, same country, they also created a large block of voters, which was going to be taken advantage of by the Democrats and that Tammany Hall political machine in New York City we talked about with the draft riots. It all goes hand in hand. Now, this situation is all what's taking place on the eve of the American Civil War, with this abolition of slaves front and center in their minds. Because, Mary, if you're an Irish worker, you're having a tough enough time finding work. The concept of freed slaves competing with them and flooding the job market in the North is their worst nightmare by far.
Yeah, because, the Irish made very, very low wages, but the freed slaves would work for less, and they did work for less, unfortunately. But the Irish were fearing that because they were struggling enough to get jobs. So there's that happening. And you see that again, too, in the movie Gangs in New York with the draft riots. And that's why they target the African-Americans.
Absolutely. This anti-Irish sentiment in the North was so strong that many considered Irish and slaves is almost the same. So for the end of slavery meant two lower classes competing for the same jobs, and the Irish knew it. So one advantage the Irish did have was they were allowed to serve in the army. And so many in New York City joined the state militia, which was a state-run militia, like an organization that would train troops to join the United States Army in case there was ever a war. So whether to earn some extra money or perhaps maybe to gain some respect from their American neighbors, many of these Irish joined the militia. One of the leaders in the New York militia was a guy named Michael Corcoran, the man who's the phrase pro-Irish is the understatement of the century,
Yes.
Corcoran, a little background on him, he was born on September 21st, 1827 in Carrickkeel, Ireland, and was the son of a British Army officer. Now, during the 1846, during the potato famine, Corcoran is going to join the Revenue Police. This is basically a group designed to kind of go bust illegal whiskey distillers.
Yeah.
So really, Corcoran was kind of like the Irish Elliot Ness at this point. Yeah. That was his job. Now, he was also part of an Irish rebellion group called the Ribbons Men, and which excelled in all the fun-loving stuff, mayhem and destruction, and avenging those Irish Catholics being persecuted by the British Protestants. Now, he began to draw their ire There you go. Wow. Right. And of the British government. So on August 30th of 1849, Corcoran is going to leave Ireland for New York City to avoid being imprisoned.
Yeah. It was found out that he was part of this group, and the Irish police were like, no, no more. And these ribbon men were going around burning barns and crops in the field. They crippled the cattle and they destroyed farm equipment. It was just, think a lot of what kind of the stories you hear about Sherman on the March to the Sea. These are like what the bummers, like that's what they were.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Kind of group. I mean, New York City prison. I don't know, I guess, but they chose New York City. Right. And so basically, he's going to arrive in New York in October of 1849, and he's going to find work as a clerk. But what he wanted to do was join the United States military, because what he wanted, and this is going to be a common theme throughout this, he wanted to learn how to be a soldier and an officer so someday he could take that knowledge and return to Ireland to help his country be freed from British rule. So to that end, he's going to join the Irish Fenian Brotherhood, Mary, some group you know pretty well.
Yep.
This is in 1848. And he's going to start to recruit Irish to be armed and trained for this ultimate goal of Irish independence, right? So 1854, jump a couple of years ahead now. Corcoran is going to join that state militia group that I mentioned, and he's going to enlist in the 69th New York. By 1858, he was already their colonel. Now, Corcoran, he was a hot-headed fellow, Mary. Yep. He hated England so much, he made Sam Adams blush. That's how that's how bad this guy was. He hated the monarchy. He hated Big Ben. He hated the Spice Girls. He hated all of it, everything. So by 1860, he ends up being court-martialed and removed from command of the 69th for what? For refusing to march in a parade with the 69th Militia honoring the Prince of Wales, Edward VII.
Yep.
I don't want to do it. I ain't doing it. You can't make me do it.
Yeah, he just thought, like, he sent a letter to his superiors, which, good on him, saying, like, I can't in good conscience do this with my men. I'm Irish. No way. Or, you know, and this is the guy that has been involved in starving the Irish. And he also considered him to be a tyrant. So, nope. Wasn't going to do it.
And this is all going on. It's really when the rebels, the Confederates fired on Fort Sumter in April of 1861, that really got Corcoran off the hook, because his charges were dropped and he was restored to command of the 69th New York because due to his popularity with the Irish in New York City and his success in recruiting Irish to fight for the Union Army. He's like, well, we're going to put you back in command. That Edward VII thing, he'll deal with it. You know, we're going to move forward with it. And, you know, it's funny, when the war started, you know, some Irish really respected the Southern position. Now think about it. The South's fighting for their independence, rebellion. It kind of goes right part and parcel to what it is. So many really saw, but a lot of them saw the war like Corcoran did.
Yeah.
Is really a chance to earn that real-time valuable experience, take home and fight for fight their own war someday. So for people like Corcoran, the American Civil War was really a training exercise. It wasn't a war to preserve the Union or any of that stuff, because the Union hated his people. That's so you could just imagine the dilemma these people had, right? Now, Corcoran 69 is going to be called up to federal service almost immediately. You know, after Sumter gets fired, he's told to report to Washington in April of 1861. So immediately, what does Corcoran do? He's going to start to recruit Irish, you know, to go ahead and start filling his ranks.
Yep.
Now, little did he know, Mary, that one of his best recruiters would be a guy with a similar background who also saw the war as an opportunity to eventually fight for Irish independence, an immigrant named Thomas Francis Marr. Now, Thomas Marr was born in Waterford, Ireland, but he was hardly made of crystal there. Anyway, forget it. Never mind. Okay. So in 1848, he's part of the young Irelanders national group that participated in the 1848 rebellion. He was captured and convicted of sedition. Now, although he was initially sentenced to death, his sentence was reduced to life in prison in Australia. Now, we're not going to get into Marr's history in Ireland. It's a great history. If you're interested in Irish history, study Thomas Marr, his days in Ireland. But that's a whole other deal for a whole different podcast that focuses on that. But basically, suffice it to say, in 1852, Marr is going to escape from prison. He's going to leave prison and make his way to New York City. and he's going to become a journalist of all things, while maintaining his efforts, you know, for the Irish cause back home.
He's given a hero's welcome when he arrives, he is. Too. And he goes on like this lecture tour, and he becomes one of the most famous Irishmen in America.
He is. When the war begins, Marr, he's going to seize the opportunity to join Corcoran's 69th New York and immediately begin to recruit. Marr is going to put an advertisement in the New York Tribune. He mentioned the thing. He was a journalist. He writes, 100 young Irishmen, healthy, intelligent, and active, wanted at once to form a company under the command of Thomas Francis Marr. So his recruiting drive was successful, and he ends up being the captain of the new Company K in the 69th New York. Now, you mentioned before how he was a speaker. Ironically, a lot of where the places Marr spoke was in the South.
Yeah, and
that's where he spoke. The importance of rebellion to the Southern audience. And they're all like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. Yeah. But ultimately, their support for the institution of slavery ultimately led him to support the Union.
Yeah, and he was quite fond of the South, you know, in the same way that I think General William Tecumseh Sherman was. But at the end of the day, they were like, we are fighting for the Union. You know, and it's interesting, too, that one of the people that was influential in helping recruit men to this brigade was he's a priest. His name was John Hughes, and he was a priest in New York. And he would basically say, you have to join the cause. And he's apparently one of the other people that is influential in getting people to join in on this.
He was, and you can miss the obvious Breakfast Club.
Yeah, John Hughes. I thought of that one.
but the thing about it, though, is, you know, Corcoran, again, in Marr, there's a quote here that Marr says. He says, it is not our duty to America, but to Ireland. Mm-hmm. So what, you know, they basically, he goes on, he goes, we cannot hope to succeed in our effort to make Ireland a republic without the moral and material support of the liberty-loving citizens of the United States, which is hilarious because that's a tongue-in-cheek comment, because he knows how they've been treated, but he knows that there's an opportunity here.
Yeah.
We can go ahead and we can learn from these people, fight from these people, and we can go back. So what's Corcoran going to do? He's going to gather his men in New York, and there's going to be a huge parade, and they're going to feel the cheers of New Yorkers cheering down.
Yeah.
And you got to imagine that must have been strange, because this is a complete 180 of the experience they've felt in the city. Now they're being cheered because they're fighting for the Union. They're going to arrive in Washington, D.C., and they're going to be trained at Fort Corcoran. Okay. Yep. And it's in Arlington, Virginia, one of 68 forts protecting the capital during the Civil War. Ironically, the site of Fort Corcoran is just south of the modern day Lee Highway, whatever.
Interesting.
It's just north of the Arlington National Cemetery, whatever. It doesn't matter. But Corcoran is going to use this time to really drill his men of the 69th really, really hard, as well as build fortifications. Now, these dudes worked, and they were told to build fortifications that it was going to take 3,000 men in 3 weeks to build. The 69th built it with 1,200 men in 1 week.
Wow.
That's how hard these dudes worked, right? So this is all going on across the Potomac at the White House. Abraham Lincoln, Mary. The guy with the hat. Now he's sitting there and he's getting nervous and he's getting impatient because what's going on? While these troops are training and building forts, he knows the clock is ticking. Why? Because these men signed 3-month papers.
Yeah.
That's it. So the thing about it is, you know, including Corcoran's guys, they're new. Dare I say, Corcoran's men are green, right?
Ooh.
Anyway. but they're not ready to fight yet. We talk about this whole thing with McDowell and McClellan and their slow. Yep. These guys need to be trained. Mm-hmm. And these guys are right literally off the boat. They're coming out of clerks' offices. They were coming out of farms. That's who these people were. And these guys, I mean, again, there's that famous story where one of the Irish Brigade guys walks into a magazine of black powder with his pipe lit, and they got to stop him from blowing up the whole fort. But this is who these people were. They just don't know. But nonetheless, Lincoln's not going to want to wait much longer. So they all went, including the 69th New York, down to a railroad junction in Manassas, Virginia, where they will face they will see the elephant for the first time on July 21st, 1861, what will be known as the Battle of First Manassas, Bull Run, if you're nasty, right? That's what it's going to be called. Now, Corcoran's 69th is going to find itself as part of Daniel Tyler's 1st Division in the 3rd Brigade under their commander, a red-headed Ohioan named William T. Sherman. Perhaps you've heard of him. Now, Sherman, always the inclusive fella, no question, shockingly hated the Irish Brigade, the Irish men, and conversely, they hated him too. They just did not get along. You know, it was. So basically, it'll be the afternoon of July 21st, what will be known as the First Battle of Manassas. In the 69th New York, the Fighting Irish will see action. Now, on their green regimental flag, under a sunburst, an Irish harp, was written in Gaelic. It says, Riam nar druid o sparn ion, which is Gaelic and translate to, Mary, you've had enough too much to drink. That's what exactly what it says.
Who never retreated from the clash of spears.
Okay, go with that. Convince yourself of that. That's fine. But you're right. Now, Corcoran's 69th, they're going to pass over the Stone Bridge and then go to advance to Henry Hill House, where they're going to initially run into troops from Louisiana. And initially, they will be on the left of the brigade of guess who?
Oh, who is that?
Oliver Otis Howard.
There's your Howard reference.
There you go, right? Now, the thing about the 69th New York is they wore gray uniforms at the time. And so, which allowed them to get right up to the Confederate lines. I mean, the uniforms were all messed up.
At the time, they had no uniformity in the uniforms. There's my joke for this episode. Okay, thanks for coming.
Oh, God, I didn't realize I was dealing with Don Rickles today. But in any case, but the uniforms was a deal where everything was going back and forth. When they got to Henry Hill House, because of the heat, the men removed their jackets and then charged. A correspondent from the Harper's Weekly, he wrote about this in 69th. He wrote, the Irish stripped themselves and rushed into the enemy with utmost fury. The difficulty was keeping them quiet. So that's, you can imagine, right? Yeah. Now, they eventually are going to fall back. They're going to take 192 casualties, including 40 men killed. One of the survivors said of this Irish regiment charge of the 69th, it was training school to open men's eyes to the real necessities of war. Now, among the casualties was their colonel, Michael Corcoran, who was captured along with 30 or so of the Irish 69th, and he's going to get shipped off to Libby Prison in Richmond, Virginia. Now it's funny, Corcoran's eventually is going to get released from Libby, and he's going to return to the army. But his days with his hand-picked Irishmen in the Irish Brigade that will later be called are over. April of 1863, Corcoran finds himself trying to pass through a picket line of the 9th New York in Richmond. And when stopped by a sentry, not sure if the sentry said, howdy, friend, where are you headed? but he was stopped. When Corcoran didn't have the necessary password to pass through, he got pissed off. And what does he do? He's going to shoot and kill the commander of the 9th New York, Edgar Addison Kimball. And some reason, who knows why, Corker was never arrested or punished. And it's likely because there's some stories that Kimball was drunk, was mouthing off anti-Irish stuff, and Corcoran got pissed and killed him. But whatever it was, Corcoran is going to go his own direction. He's going to end up recruiting for a separate Irish group called the Corcoran Legion, and eventually got command of a division in the 22nd Corps under General Samuel Heintzelman in Washington. He was ordered to help defend those forts. We talked a little about Heintzelman and stuff like that. But anyway, one day late in December of 1863, Corcoran's riding on his horse in Fairfax, Virginia. He's going to get thrown off his horse. He's going to fracture his skull. He's going to die on December 22nd of 1863 at the W.P. Gunnell House in Fairfax. Ironically, we visited. Mosby. It's the same house that John Mosby caught Stoughton in.
Spanked him.
And he certainly did. And it's kind of strange because, a strange and ignominious death for such an Irish soldier with such a pedigree.
Yeah.
And we'll see later on, he's not going to be the only Irish leader of this brigade who's going to kind of die a weird and lonely death. We'll get to him later. Okay. But anyways, with Colonel Michael Corcoran being captured in their 3 months papers expiring, most of the survivors of the 69th New York, what do? They quit.
Yep.
They don't sign up.
I probably wouldn't do after Bull Run. I mean, that was kind of a shit show.
He was. So there's going to be a new commander, Thomas Marr,
yep.
in the former captain of Company K. He's going to be promoted up. Now, with few men remaining, Marr is going to have to do a total rebuild from scratch. And really, this time when he's signing his men, he's smart. You know what he does? He signed the 3-year papers. Yep. He ain't stupid, right? Now, once the 69th New York was filled again, he eventually filled 4 additional regiments to form what will be forever known as the Irish Brigade. So along with the 69th New York, he added the 63rd New York from Staten Island, New York, the 88th New York from the Bronx, as well as the 116th PA from Philadelphia, which is going to come later on. They're going to come later, but that's who it's going to be. Another regiment, it's the 29th Massachusetts. This is non-Irish. Oh, how the
this
heck?
This is so funny. It was a mistake. They were supposed to get the 28th. But the 29th is from Plymouth County. And so they're descended from pilgrims and stuff. And you can't even, like, you know, they have been in, their families have been here for, like, how many years? And they're fighting with these Irish guys, a lot of them immigrants, right? It just was like...
Leave it to the United States Army to find the only non-Irish guys in Boston. But that's the case. But it's called the Pilgrim Regiment. Yeah. That's exactly who they are. From our neck of the woods right here. Okay. So this brigade, for the most part, it's full of Irish, and they were very cohesive. It sounded like it was gonna be really, really good, but there are problems. There are political problems that are coming out of Washington, and that anti-Irish nativist sentiment we talked about, it's gonna resurface again. Hmm. The problem in Washington wasn't an all-Irish brigade. The problem with the powers that be was they weren't too comfortable having an Irish man, formerly an agitator from the old country like Marr, to lead it.
Yeah.
What they wanted was an American to lead it. So instead of Marr, they compromised. They found a guy who was born in Ireland but came here a lot earlier, named James Shields. Mm-hmm. So James Shields is going to be the initial commander of the Irish Brigade. Now, Shields is born in Elmore, Ireland, but he came to the U.S. in 1826. So he didn't experience a potato famine. He didn't experience a lot of the unrest that existed in Ireland in the 1840s and 1850s. James Shields was living in Springfield, Illinois in 1842 when someone named Aunt Becca began publishing negative letters about Shields in the newspaper. Now, Shields was pissed off. He publicly challenged Aunt Becca to a duel, which never happened, which is probably good in the overall picture, because who's Aunt Becca?
Aunt Becca is Abraham Lincoln. And it's quite Abraham possibly Lincoln. Mary Lincoln helping him out, too.
So it's just kind of funny how these whole things kind of these all kind of go together. But as you can imagine, these Irish troops didn't take too well to losing Marr as their brigade commander for a guy who they didn't consider Irish. Think of losing Franz Siegel and bringing in Howard with the 11th. Oh, it's the same sentiment, kind of.
It's like, I mean, it's a clash of cultures. I mean, Marr is going to understand those guys better than what Shields is, right? Even though Shields is born in Ireland, he's basically coming over here as, you know, he's really young when he does. So he doesn't experience the famine like Marr is and all that.
But, you know, what Shields is, though, is he's smart, okay? And what he does is something that's very ultimately self-serving, but brilliant. You know what he's going to do? He's going to call a meeting with Marr, and then he's going to write a letter to Washington. And I'm going to read a portion of the letter. He's going to write, I'm not going to say in an Irish accent, I'm just going to read.
Thank you.
Okay. Then you're welcome. I wish to say a few words relative to myself and the brigade. I was in the western states of Mexico endeavoring to recruit my shattered health when I received the intelligence of my appointment as to the general of the Irish Brigade. On my arrival in New York, I was sorry to find there was a misunderstanding relative to General Marr and myself. I know General Marr very well. You did right in selecting him to command your brigade. He is better qualified for that position than 3/4 of the men who have been appointed to similar commands. I hope to have the Irish Brigade with its gallant brigadier, Thomas Marr, at some future day in my division of the army. So what does he do? That letter promotes himself to division.
Yep.
Right? So now he's going to be the division commander. So Marr is going to run the Irish Brigade, but still under Shields' tutelage. And guess what? It friggin' works.
Yep.
Washington, he writes a letter, gets promoted, and they go, well, he's still commanding the Irish, but not what we wanted. This looks a pretty good deal.
Honestly, it's probably, he probably gets promoted because of Abraham Lincoln and that connection. And like Abraham Lincoln never like to talk about that duel. Some guy brought it up and Lincoln was like, if you value your life, you will never bring this up again in my presence.
Absolutely.
Like, he was, I mean, so embarrassed by it.
The super sports agent Scott Boras could not have pulled off a better deal. I mean, this he really did it. He really did himself some well. So now the Irish Brigade, under his direct control, Thomas Marr, begins the heavy task of recruiting. Mm-hmm. Now, he's tasked to recruit 2,000 men to keep the Irish Brigade intact. So after his first attempt, guess how many men he's able to sign out of 2,000?
Like, I don't know, 2,000?
250! That's it! Only 250. July 25th, 1862, Marr is going to be in New York City speaking to a large Irish crowd like he's a football coach pushing Irish pride and Irish manhood with the ranks. You've got to join for the old country. But what he didn't know was that the previous members of the 69th who hadn't signed up again when their three-month papers expired were working against him, and he didn't know it. See, those former members came home and told everybody how miserable their experience was. And whatever you do, unless you're an officer, do not join the army. Don't do it. One former Irish soldier, he from the 69th, the original, he described life with the Union Army. He wrote, the Union Army as a perfect hell of vulgarity, profanity, and tyranny. To me, it sounds like an afternoon in the bleachers at Yankee Stadium. Yeah. But that's how he experienced his experience with the 69.
But profanity, that is funny. Like them saying, yeah. Like, you got to wonder, what was he hearing? I mean, not to be stereotypical, but
well, a lot of these guys are Irish Catholics, though.
Oh, that's
and
true.
They,
yeah.
I mean, but so they don't want, but they're saying, listen, I don't care what this dude says. I don't care where he's from. I don't care what his goal is. Just, these aren't the droids you're looking for. Just don't do it. Stay away. Right. So for the most part, a few months later in September of 1862, Robert E. Lee's army of Northern Virginia, they're going to find themselves marching into Maryland. Mm-hmm. And both armies will famously clash in Sharpsburg on the 17th of September at the Battle of Antietam. Right.
Yeah.
Now, commanding this Union army at this point was General George McClellan, who the Irish Brigade absolutely loved. Mm-hmm. They loved Little Mac. They did, because he was cautious. He didn't take their lives. He didn't treat them like dogs, like they were used to being treated. He valued human life more than soldier life in their minds, right? So, you know, despite whatever caution that McClellan displayed, it was here at the Battle of Antietam that the Irish Brigade really got their names in the annals of Civil War combat.
Mm-hmm.
The Irish Brigade is going to be the 2nd Brigade in Israel Richardson's 1st Division of Edwin Sumner's 2nd Corps. Now, their task will be to attack and hold a small sunken road in the middle of the battlefield, which will later, of course, be known as Bloody Lane. And, you know, a lot of people know about the story, but it's interesting how it leads up to this. Now, Marr has his 88th New York under Patrick Kelly. The 69th is now under James Kelly. The 63rd is now commanded by John Burke. And that non-Irish 29th Massachusetts, the Puritan Regiment, is under Joseph Burns. At about 9:30 in the morning, the Irish Brigade is going to cross Antietam Creek in a place called Prize Ford. Now, they form to the edge of a cornfield where their chaplain, Boston College fan William Corby, Mary,
sure he is.
is riding along on horseback. Anyway, he's riding along on horseback, giving the men their absolution, you know, before battle. Mm-hmm. He'll do this a lot, but this is when he does it at Antietam. Now, the 69th New York is going to form on the right, followed by the 29th Mass, those non-Irish guys, then the 63rd, and then the 88th as they begin to cross a cornfield. Now, it should be noted, the Irish Brigade did not carry rifled muskets. They didn't. They carried 69 caliber smoothbore buck and ball rifles, which are far less accurate than the rifle musket, and which required men for the most part to fight in much closer distance to be effective. The smoothbores are effective at 25 yards, but beyond that, there's no guarantee. At 100 yards, they aren't really accurate at all. So that put them at a great disadvantage when the Confederates, who had Enfields and Springfields for the most part, were firing upon them at a much further range, right? In their front of the sunken road were regiments from George B. Anderson's division, brigade in D.H. Hill's division. We're talking the 2nd, the 4th, the 14th, and the 30th North Carolina. Now, Marr will be leading the Irish Brigade forward, riding his horse. And once they reach the crest of the ridge, they're going to be stopped flat by the rebel fire. Mm-hmm. Burke's 63rd New York is going to be hit hard once the fire begins. They're going to be pounded. Marr's horse will be shot and killed, throwing him from it. The 88th New York, they're the ones under Patrick Kelly. They're going to advance towards the sunken road and get about 500 yards from it. But again, they weren't ordered. They weren't ordered to fire. No. Because why? The smoothbores won't reach. Yep. So they're just standing around, staring at each other.
Just going to stare,
right? Just going to stare. A soldier in the 88th New York, he said of this assault, "The shot and shell of the enemy poured over our heads and crashed into the hollow of the rear. The bullets were whirring a boot, but we had not commenced to fire yet." Before long, what happens? The color bearers start to be dropped one after the other. Captain Patrick Clooney from Company E of the 88th, a native of Waterford. Again, not Crystal. He's only 20. He's just 22 years old. He's going to pick up the fallen regimental flag. He's going to be shot through the knee, but he's somehow able to still get up, and he's going to waddle his way to within 30 feet of the sunken road before being killed instantly when he's shot in the head and chest at the same time. Now, no one knows who Patrick Clooney is, but Patrick Clooney, he's buried in Calvary Cemetery in Queens, New York. And this cemetery, if you're ever in Queens, is where a lot of the Irish Brigade guys are buried. This includes Michael Corcoran when he dies, as well as John Buford's cavalry commander, Thomas Devon, the cavalry guy. Not sure if his burial spot is the best damn ground he's ever seen.
Probably is.
but that's where he's buried. Oh, by the way, fun fact, you know who else is buried in the cemetery? Singer Tony Bennett.
Really?
And the great actor from Blazing Saddles, Dom DeLuise.
Interesting.
So if you go to the cemetery, you can go visit them all. But that's where they're all buried. But despite this valiant effort, the Irish Brigade, they're going to struggle to break the line of the sunken road, but they put up a hell of a fight. Yeah. They're fighters. That's who they are. One of the North Carolinians fighting them of the Irish Brigade, he's going to say, "The Irish stood in line on the ridge in plain view with three flags as colors. One of the stars and stripes, one a state flag, and one green flag with the harp of Erin. Our men kept the flags falling fast, but just as fast they were raised up again, still defiant. Antietam to this date remains the bloodiest day in American history, and the Irish Brigade significantly added to this butcher's bill."
Yeah.
Just looking at these casualties, the 69th New York ended the day with just 100 men left. They lost 61% casualties. The 63rd New York lost 60% of their men, 6-0. Combined, those two regiments lost 600 men alone. The 88th got off easy, only losing 38% of their men. So this was Antietam, yep, right? And anybody who studies Antietam knows. But it absolutely ripped the Irish Brigade to shreds, including those battle flags we talked about.
Yep.
They were so shot up and ripped apart that they were sent back to New York City for repair. They lost their flags.
Wow.
And they weren't captured. They were shot to hell. Following the Battle of Antietam, the Irish Brigade, Mary, is going to literally get insult added to their injury, literally and figuratively, with a double dose of FU. The first one is on September 22nd, 1862, less than a week after the battle. Abraham Lincoln is going to release his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, which does what?
That's going to free the slaves that are...
It's going to free the slaves in rebel territory. Yeah. For the Irish, this was their worst nightmare. Like we said earlier, this was what they did not want.
Yeah.
You know, with the war's goals being shifted really for ending slavery, it meant that when it was all over, they're going to have to compete with free slaves for those low-paying jobs back home, assuming they won. The second bit of bad news that they got was they learned their beloved commander, George McClellan, got the heave-ho, just like the Buffalo Bills in the playoffs every single year. And reportedly, many of the men of the Irish Brigade, they openly wept when they heard this news.
Yeah.
So just imagine, you fight, you're losing 60%, 61%, 38%, you're losing all your flags, right? Now, Emancipation Proclamation is coming down. You lose McClellan. And guess what? You're not even fighting for your own freaking country.
No.
But you know what, though? Energizer Bunny, they kept going.
Yeah, they keep going for whatever reason. They keep going, you know, and they're gonna like the next battle they're going to be involved in is Fredericksburg in December of 1862.
It is. And there's going to be a big change, though. There's going to be a big reformation in this whole thing. Irish Brigade is still going to be under Thomas Marr, but now they have a new overall commander in the Second Corps. Guess who?
Hancock?
No. Winfield Scott Hancock.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, I got it.
The Candy Man himself. He's going to be taking over this. He's going to be taking over the Second Corps. Right now, this is when you mentioned before the mistake in the regiments.
Yeah.
The 28th Mass, the Puritan Regiment. They're going to get replaced with the 28th Massachusetts under Richard Burns from he's from County Cavan, Ireland. This is the guy who briefly served under Benjamin Butler in the Carolinas.
Yeah.
But the 28th Massachusetts was the prototypical Irish. I mean, that's who these people were, right? Dunkin' Donuts flowing out of their friggin' veins. That's how fast they were, right? The 28th Mass, they carried that unique green Tiffany flag and their regimental motto was, of course, Fa'abala, which means clear the road. And it would become one of the more famous battle cries in the entire Union Army. If you go to the monuments today, Gettysburg, you still see Fa'abala. This is specific to the 28th Massachusetts. They also added the 116th, we kind of hinted them earlier, from Philadelphia under the command of Colonel Dennis Heenan. Now, these guys were green as well. They arrived near Fredericksburg directly from their training camp in Washington after just a few weeks of skirmishing in the Shenandoah, so they didn't see much. So there are also some regimental changes in the old Irish Brigade. Colonel Robert Nugent is now in charge of the 69th, who replaced the injured Daniel Kelly, who got wounded at Antietam. Now, the one thing they could not replace were those green regimental flags that were shipped back to New York City for repair that got shot apart. So you know what they did instead of the flags?
Didn't they sew? I don't know. I don't know.
Okay, well, that's a great answer. Yeah. That's okay. Yeah. So in lieu of flags, the men, what they did is they put green sprigs of boxwood trees into their caps. So to know each other as the Irish Brigade, but also as a way to follow each other into battle. And you see the pictures from Fredericksburg, you see the sprigs. That's what they are. Now, this will be the situation when the new commander Ambrose Burnside's army will begin the Battle of Fredericksburg on Saturday, December 13th, 1862. The Irish Brigade will once again put up front, which they tend to do, and they are going to fight brutally.
Yep. Mary's Heights, one guy said, they're going to lead us over in front of those guns, which we have seen placing unhindered for the past 3 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Irish, you know, for the most part, they're going to be part of Edward Sumner's left wing now.
Yeah.
And they're going to cross the Rappahannock and they're going to proceed through those open fields towards the Heights, which is outside of town, targeting the area on the mansion built by John Murray. It's known today as Brompton Mansion, but positioned on Murray's Heights were rebel artillery and infantry behind a stone wall and a sunken road. I mean, it's just a brutal place. The 116th Pennsylvania. They're going to be seeing this. They're going to see these battle for the first time here. Their lieutenant colonel, a guy named St. Clair Augustine, he's from Lisbon, Ireland, and future Philadelphia police chief, Mary, of all things. He's
going to
be late after the war. He's going to write this about the regiment's baptism of fire. He's going to write, the hills rained with fire and the men advanced with heads bowed, walking towards a hailstorm. Still through the deadly shower, the ever-thinning lines pressed on. The plain over which they passed was covered with men of the Second Corps, dead in twos and threes. The men of the Irish Brigade, they pressed up that slope towards that stone wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and this is one of the more fascinating stories of the Civil War, in my opinion. Behind the stone wall is a brigade of Georgians under Thomas R.R. Cobb. He's a lawyer. He's a fire-eating, fun lover. He's everything. He's the Confederate. He plays the part. 16th, 18th, 24th, 4th Georgia, okay? Within his brigade, it ended up creating a true brother-on-brother situation. Yeah. The 24th Georgia was made up of guess who?
Irish.
Of Irish. Yeah. Now, it's funny. It's funny how history is. The men of the 24th, similar story as the others. They escaped Ireland to travel to the United States. But by happenstance, by fate, they emigrated to Savannah, Georgia, instead of New York City. So when the war started, they fought for the Confederacy. Yep. It's just because that's where the boat took them. That's where they fought.
I mean, it makes sense. Like,
of course it does. Yeah. But the colonel was a guy named Robert McMillan. And likewise, you know, he fought, you know, they fought under a green flag with the harp and the whole deal. So it's a cruel irony that on this day, when the Union made that fifth fatal charge at Marie's Heights, that was when Mars men advanced, both sides knew they were fighting Irish brothers. Yeah. One of the Irish Confederates in the 24th, Georgia, he says, he's seeing Mars guys coming up with a sprig in their hat. And he says, oh, what a pity. Here comes Mars fellows.
Yeah.
So they knew who they were fighting. Thomas Marr, he's going to be injured here. He's going to be shot in the knee. He's going to climb up his white horse before a shell fragment is going to knock him out of the saddle. And as he's being carried to the rear, he's yelling, load and fire at will. He's got his dandruff. His face is red. You can only imagine. So as a battle rages up on that slope, many of the Union Irish, you know, they're lying on their stomachs just to find shelter. The bullets are whizzing by. Some are hiding behind a stone shed. When the battle stalled, Major James Cavanaugh, the 69th New York, he's rallying his men. He's yelling, blaze away, stand it, boys. And the men are now 50 feet away from the stone wall. Mm-hmm. If you've been to Fredericksburg, I know there's housing developments and people are all mad, but if you go there and you see, you're standing at that wall, you have 50, you probably have 100 feet of grass in front of you. Mm-hmm. That's where the Irish Brigade got. You can still see it. Captain John O'Neill, he took a bullet in the chest and a lodge in his spine. Okay. The color bearer, Sergeant William Tyrell, was hit by an exploding shell, but managed to get himself up on one knee before he was hit with 5 mini balls at once in the chest. Oh. Boom, 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 boom. The battle along the Stonewall of Fredericksburg was some of the most vicious and some of the most personal in the entire American mm-hmm. Civil War. After the battle, even the Confederates, they were in awe of what they saw with these Union guys. None other than Confederate General George Pickett, Mary, of all people, he writes to his fiancée, Sally, about the charge of the Irish Brigade. Pickett's going to write, your soldier, you know, meaning him, your soldier's heart almost stood still as he watched those sons of Erin fearlessly rush up to their deaths. Their brilliant assault on Marie's Heights of the Irish Brigade was beyond description. We forgot they were fighting us, and cheer after cheer went up because of their fearlessness went up about the lines. So they were fighting so hard, the Rebs were cheering them.
Yeah.
That's how guys were going. A rebel artillerist in Washington Artillery from Louisiana, he writes, the gallantry of the enemy pushed on beyond all charges and fought as they left their dead 20 paces from the sunken road. Even on the Union side, old Winnie Boy, Winsfield Scott Hancock, he says to Marr after the assault of Marie's Heights, General Marr, I have never seen anything so splendid.
Yeah.
Okay.
And yet, the way the Irish were writing about it, though, they write, like, the men who fought in the Irish Brigade, they write, you can get a, like, you definitely get a sense of just how horrific and bloody this battle was. One soldier from the 88th New York wrote, the Battle of Fredericksburg should be written in letters of blood on the banners of the Irish Brigade. And another, Captain William J. Nagel of the 88th New York said, Irish blood and Irish bones cover that terrible field today. We are slaughtered like sheep and no result but defeat. And then another one said, as for the remnant of the brigade, they were the most dejected set of Irishmen you ever saw or heard of. And this is after the battle, how they were feeling.
The quotes go on up. Father Corby, he writes about this happens. The place where Mars Brigade was sent was truly a slaughter pen. Now, when you look at the numbers, there's some more quotes we'll talk about. But the Battle of Fredericksburg ends. The Irish Brigade will have seen 14 of their 15 officers cut down, as well as 512 of their 1,000 men. That's gigantic. They earn the respect from both sides for fighting through this pure hell right up to that stone wall before falling back. When Mars men, when they finally said enough is enough and they started to fall back, the Irish on the 24th Georgia, you know what they did? They stood and cheered them. Despite losing 100 men of their own to these men, when they started falling back and they were clearly retreating, they got a standing ovation from the Confederate Irish for their effort. And that's just amazing. And those stories are incredible. You know, a Private Welsh, Peter Welsh of the 28th Mass, he writes to his wife after the battle. He writes, thank God I came out safe. Our brigade got terribly cut up. It is so small now that it is unfit into any further action unless it is recruited up.
Yep.
I mean, it's fat. People who've been to Fredericksburg and studied the battle, and everyone knows the carnage
of it.
It's
tougher to get an idea of what happened there just because of, like, the developments and stuff. But you can go there, and if you go there having, like, you know, this kind of in your mind, you know, it is a very, very powerful place. And, like, what you said about that soldier saying, we need to have more recruits, that is going to factor into the aftermath of Fredericksburg, because that is not a good time for the Irish Brigade after Fredericksburg. It's not a good time for the Army of the Potomac in general. It's one of their, Olive Rodas Howard would say that this time after Fredericksburg is, morale is at the lowest it's ever been. You know,
there's no question.
Yeah.
We'll talk about this in a second, but it's kind of hard when you're trying to rally an army, and you're trying your best and it just isn't happening. I mean, like you said, despite it all, Mar's goal was, again, to try to gain experience to take home for Irish independence. But his men were rock bottom. I mean, they were. And I know you got some stuff to talk about the posting, but as that calendar flips from 62 into 63, they fall back into winter quarters, the Union Army, and the Irish Brigade are going to have a really, really tough time.
Yeah. And so in January of 1863, Mar is going to return to New York for a high mass, recognizing the sacrifices that the Irish Brigade have made. And he is going to discover that things are not good on the home front in New York City for the Irish and their feeling toward the Civil War. And it probably goes back to what you were talking about with these guys from the 69th that only signed, you know, the 3-month papers, that they're going back and be like, this was hell. This is not worth it. Don't join up. The Irish in New York... Irish in New York are also reading the newspapers, and, you know, the ones that come out after Antietam, but also now that Mar's back there, they are reading the ones that are coming out after Fredericksburg as well, and the lengthy casualty reports, and it's just kind of, you know, feeding into what they already know. Their impression of this is it's not good to join the Union Army and fight. So Mar is also warned that the recruitment of Irishmen would only work if men could be found to volunteer. You know, Colonel James Meehan of the Irish Brigade commented on the lack of account in any New York newspaper about the brigade at Fredericksburg. He said, though we were certain that we had fought well and bravely, yet we wished to have the particulars, every other brigade being particularized. So they're mentioning other brigades in the Army of the Potomac. They're not mentioning the Irish Brigade. And these guys, you know, they fought just as hard, like they went through whatever, and they want to be recognized for what happened. And because of all the losses, you know, Mar is kind of like, you know, we need to move this brigade from the field. We need to get more men in it. We need to, like, you know, get our numbers up a bit, just as you said with that one quote from the soldier. And New York's warning to the War Department, like Mar... There was one warning that said, to bring them into conflict with the enemy in their present condition is an outrage on the humanity on which we trust the government will not be guilty. And this is New York. This is an Irish newspaper's warning to the War Department saying, you need to help us out. Mar pushes Lincoln and Stanton to grant the Irish Brigade special leave to rest and recruit its depleted ranks. At times, he does not hear back from either the War Department or from Lincoln. And at other times, War Department or officials are telling him there's not enough troops to grant or leave for the brigade. Keep in mind, they're in winter quarters at this point, and other brigades in the Army of the Potomac are getting leave. One soldier in the Irish Brigade wrote to his mother and said, we thought surely our brigade was going home to New York, but we were kept back. It would not be let go in account of we being Irish. So they know what's happening. And the Irish in New York are becoming very angry at the way the brigade's being treated. An editor of the Irish American said, it appears to me if they were the most anxious to blot out our race altogether. They seem not to recollect the fact that they are doing all in their power to demoralize the remnant of a magnificent brigade. And Boston's Irish newspaper, The Pilot, said, the Irish spirit for the war is dead, absolutely dead. And this is what they're dealing with after Fredericksburg. This, and you know, it's a combination of what you mentioned with the men with the 3-month papers going back from the 69th to New York and talking about it's not a good situation, but it's also the casualty lists, how high they are, especially after Fredericksburg, and just that Irish are being neglected.
And he has a tough time recruiting, but he's also got a morale problem within his troops. And he does something that is fascinating in this winter quarters. You know, it's approaching March of 1863. And what holiday is in March?
St. Patrick's Day.
So what he decides what he wants to do is he has an idea to motivate his men to hopefully get them back in a fighting spirit. Whatever, guys, we got to do. So, you know, he decides to hold a huge St. Patrick's Day celebration for his men. This celebration included a bunch of contests with prizes given away. It was kind of like a big fair. They had all these games. Games included races. They had dance-offs. They had a Dunk the Rosewoods clown booth. I mean, they had everything. They had a game where you could try to catch an oiled pig for prizes.
Oh, I remember reading about in one of the books about the Army of the Potomac.
Yeah, and so it was a big party. And naturally, Marr made sure these men had plenty of alcohol. He loaded them up. Marr made a drink for them that he called whiskey punch, okay? I happened to get the recipe for this one, Mary.
Oh, we need to make this sometime.
He had a huge barrel made with 10 gallons of rum, 8 bottles of champagne, and 22 gallons of whiskey in this big jug.
Oh.
Sounds like a Friday night in Goderich. But here,
you got to put some juice in there to the alcohol.
I mean, needless to say, Mars St. Patty's Day celebration turned into a full call me maybe situation. I mean, and that was the whole point of it. The highlight of the day was a huge steeplechase race. Over 20,000 Union soldiers came out to watch it. It was advertised in the camp, and it said, to come off the 17th of March, rain or shine, by horses, the property of, and to be ridden by the commissioned officers of the Irish Brigade. The prizes are a purse of $500. This is the steeplechase. A two and a half mile heat, best 2 out of 3, over 4 hurdles of 4.5 feet high with 5 feet ditches, including 2 artificial rivers, 15 feet wide and 6 feet deep. It was a big contest. The judge of the race, the judge who decided the winner, was guess who?
Oh.
It was Joe Hooker was the judge. Jeez. He got to decide who won. Thomas Marr himself handed out the prizes. So you can imagine just what a hit this was. Samuel Partridge of the 13th New York, he was watching. He said of the event, it was the biggest spree I ever went to. And you can only imagine just the hilarity this thing must have been. It worked because he brought the morale of his men up. He let the Irish guys have fun, got them drunk, gave them money, had prizes. They had all these food brought in, chickens and ham and DQ gift cards, ho-hos, the whole thing they brought in to rise the morale of his men. And it was brilliant on it.
Well, it makes that guy sense mentioned because of what he experienced in New York when he was back there in January, that he saw how things were. And he's probably I need to raise morale.
If you get a chance, and we're not going to talk a lot about it now, go into study this party they had. And there's a lot of stuff written about it. It is hilarious. I just kind of touched on it, but there's so much more to it. But at the end of the day, needless to say, this would have been a blast to be at. Yeah. Just imagine.
I wonder if the 11th Corps guys came over to it, because by then I think they had – no, that was before they had their beer rations cut.
Definitely.
I wonder if the 11th Corps and the Germans got involved too.
Oh, yeah. Peter Welsh, I mentioned before, the flag bearer, the guy from the 28th Massachusetts, on St. Patty's Day, he got a promotion. Again, I gave it away to be the flag bearer, the color sergeant of his 28th Mass Regiment. And for the first time, he's going to carry that battle flag a few months later in the Battle of Chancellorsville. Now, the thing about it is, kind of going with this, just imagine this Irish Brigade. They can't recruit. They're losing men because they're at the front of every battle. They're getting shot back. They're getting killed, captured. So they're losing men. It's like a car rolling down the street losing parts. That's they're losing.
Like in planes, trains, automobiles.
Exactly. So, Marr is rehabbing his injuries from Fredericksburg, It was, but he was back in time of Chancellorsville, where his men did see limited action. They mainly fought along the line by the Chancellor House, is kind of where they were. But there was no wholesale slaughter for the Irish this time. They kind of were allowed to stay back a little bit. And just understand the numbers. A year before Chancellorsville, the Irish Brigade stood at 4,000. 4,000 strong, motivated, fired guys. A year later, after the Battle of Chancellorsville, guess how many men the Irish Brigade had left?
Not many.
300.
Yeah.
So that's crazy. Basically, he needed more men, and badly, you kind of hinted at it, he wanted to go back to New York City to recruit more. Again, after Chancellorsville. And he made his request to Washington, and they said no. And for Marr, this was the final kick in his shillelagh. Yeah. That was this. He was done. He decides he's had enough. Look, I tried. This isn't happening. I'm going to give it the old quit. So despite what his men had given in blood for a country that wasn't even theirs, it was clear Washington and the Washington nativists were done with this Irish Brigade. Mm-hmm. And he ends up, Marr, resigning. He resigns his commission on May 14th, 1863. He's done. Now, the Irish Brigade did not die with Marr's resignation, although the numbers are going to be a shadow of what they used to be. By the time of the Gettysburg campaign, the 63rd, 88th, and 69th New York were down to two companies, while the 116th, the new guys, were down to four companies. You know, Patrick Kelly is now the brigade commander, and he's part of John Caldwell's division in Hancock's Second Corps. And we're not going to get into too much Gettysburg with the Irish Brigade, but the thing about it, though, is with their remaining troops, they're still going to be with those smoothbores.
Yeah,
they're going to fight hard at the wheat field on July 2nd. They fired so many rounds on the July 2nd on George Rose's 26-acre wheat field. They ran out of ammunition in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That's how hard they fought, okay? Now, the Fighting Irish still had the Fighting Irish spirit. There's no question they did, despite the fact that it was clear now this dream of earning this valuable experience and going back to Ireland was basically over. It was.
Like at Gettysburg, too, this is where Father Corby is going to give them absolution again, and he's got that statue there. And he realized he had no time to hear each man's confession individually, so he puts on the violet stole, climbed up on a rock, and gave the Irish Brigade their general absolution. Colonel St. Clair Augustine, I think you mentioned before, he writes about it from the 116th PA. But they're there, and they lose the majority of their remaining soldiers at Gettysburg.
Augustine ends up being like the historian of the 116th yeah. PA. He's an interesting read if you can find his papers. He talks a lot about it. But it was December of 1863, jumping ahead real quick, Thomas Marr's resignation is going to be kind of be rescinded by the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. They kind of take it back. He's going to be sent up to your neck of the woods, the Western Theater, Mary. Yep. He'll command a division of the Army of the Ohio before quitting for good on May 15th, 1865. He'll move to Montana.
Yep.
And he'll become their acting governor. Now, back east, though, we'll get to Marr in a second to talk about what happens with him. But back in the east, the Irish Brigade officially came to an end on June of 1864 when the United States Army basically disbanded the rest of the brigade and spread the remaining troops out among the 3rd and 4th Brigades in the 1st Division of the 1st Corps.
Yep.
So they're going to get spread out. So what's interesting about this, though, is despite the fact that the Fighting 69th New York, that there is a Civil War regiment, they still exist today.
Yep.
After the Civil War, they were part of the Rainbow Division that fought in World War I. They participated in the Pacific Theater in World War II as part of the 27th Infantry Division. Mm-hmm. In 1963, the Irish Catholic President, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, he's going to present a battle flag of the Irish Brigade to Ireland as a thank you for their support of the Union. Today, the 69th New York, it's not called the 69th New York, but what they were, can be found in the 1st Battalion, and they fought as recently as in Afghanistan.
That's really cool.
So it goes on. But we talked before about Corcoran's strange death,
yeah.
Right? Where he died, he fell off the horse in Fairfax, dies on December 22nd at the Gunnell House. Marr's personal one is a strange one, too.
Yeah, he So he's out, he's governor out in, like, he'd become secretary and acting governor out in the Montana Territory. He's going to drown in the Missouri River near Fort Benton on July the 1st, Canada Day, also anniversary of Gettysburg, 1867, and his body's never recovered. So we kind of like, he's one of these ones like, you know, Ambrose Bierce. We don't know.
Well, it's a little more than that though, yeah. You know, because while he was in Montana, he pissed off a lot of people. Mm. I mean, like he pissed off a lot of people back in the old country. And so he's going to fall July 1st, like it's 1867. He's going to fall off the steamship, the G.A. Thompson, and drown. Like you said, his body was never recovered. But there are rumors that he was murdered by enemies in Montana, and he was killed by a man who was paid $8,000 as a bounty, who basically, like 1913, fessed up to it, that he did it. But the death of Thomas Marr today remains one of history's greatest mysteries as far as whatever happened to him. But who knows? He pissed off the wrong person in Montana, yeah, and he got off. But who the hell knows? But the thing that you got to remember as we conclude this whole thing with the Irish Brigade, mm-hmm, okay? In the Union Army, one in every four soldiers came from somewhere outside of this country, Germany, Canada, a lot from Irish. And it's clear that despite their motivation to fight, it's really hard to find another group who fought hard in the Irish Brigade, because when you look at why they, where they came from, their history, how they rallied, what they fought for, where they fought, how they fought,
yep,
no brigade ever fought harder, in my opinion, than the Irish Brigade.
I agree.
So it's important, and it's important to remember them, not just, and it's, again, this, the Irish Brigade, like the Iron Brigade, is a very popular one, but when you really get into the weeds, into the clovers, as they say, and you study the Irish Brigade and you learn the personal stories, yeah, of Corcoran and Marr and all these guys we talk about, and all the men that they raised, don't forget, they were able to recruit guys to fight for a country that hated them.
Yeah.
And they fought like Wolverines. They fought to the death. And when you look at Fredericksburg and you look at Antietam, even at Gettysburg, It's tough to find a division, I mean a brigade, that fought harder. So I think it's an important study to study these guys and look at the history of what these guys came from, and why some of these guys up to 69 still fight today.
Yeah, and the remnants of them, they go right through to the end of the Civil War. They're there at Appomattox, in May of 1865. They are going to be part of the Grand Review in D.C. What's left of these guys, where they've been, you know, kind of distributed in the AOP. There was one thing that did happen in October 30th, 1864, that men from the 69th were assigned to picket duty opposite Fort Davis, which was a fortification they were defending at Petersburg. And in the middle of the night, a Confederate raiding party took the 69th by surprise. There was quite a few of them taken prisoner. They took some of the 111th New York that were right next to them, unfortunately taken prisoner as well. But this surprise raid prompted an investigation. And in the investigation, it was discovered that 10 of their new recruits had deserted, gone over to the Confederates, and divulged the details of the placement of the Union pickets outside Fort Davis. So that was one thing that did happen to them near the end of the Civil War. But these guys, what's left of them, are kind of, you know, laid out, you know, distributed throughout the Army of Potomac. Some of them are at Appomattox, what's left of them. In July 4th of 1865, the Irish Brigade marches in a victory parade in New York City. And Marr did call upon the Archdiocese to erect a cathedral and an Irish round tower in honor of them, but they never got this. They did, however, get a monument at Antietam, and they have one at Gettysburg as well, too.
They're great monuments. The one at Gettysburg is gorgeous, as is the one in Antietam. So,
interesting about the one at Gettysburg, the sculptor fought for the Confederacy.
Yeah. There's so many cool little stories with this. These intertwine, they go back and forth. Yeah. I love the fact that Marr was, you know, he was speaking in the South and he was doing all that stuff. It's just so much that goes into this. There just really is.
Well, the reasons for fighting. And two, this leads into our next episode, because we wanted to do, obviously, this is our Union episode about Ireland, for March and the Union Irish Brigade. But our next episode is going to be focused on the Confederate side, and it is going to be an episode about General Patrick Claiborne. And in him, he's kind of embodying those hard fighting, you know, things that the Irish Brigade has as well. it goes on to the other side as well. And he's obviously, he's not Catholic. He's Episcopalian, so the Protestant. And his experience is really, really interesting. But he's a guy that, you know, comes over here, makes America his home, and decides to fight for the Confederacy because of where he is in Helena, Arkansas at the time the Civil War breaks out.
Yeah, when we talk about him, and this is what I usually say, what's coming up for us next? That's Mary, but you jumped the gun on that one. Good job. No, Patrick Claiborne's an interesting study because we talk a lot about he didn't fight to learn and go back to Ireland to fight. He fought to fight for whatever home it was home. And it could have been Ohio, but it ends up being Arkansas, ends up being the South. And so he's a fascinating study. So we'll talk about him. So we'll get ready to drop that off. So we can drop this episode right now. So we, as we head off into the great unknown here. Yes. But I think it's a great study. I think this month is a great month to study a lot of these things. And Southern Patrick Claiborne is going to be an eye opener with a lot of people as well. Yeah. Because I mean, he's somebody who, when you're talking clearly underrated guys who should be bigger.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about that nativism issue we talked about with Washington, about how he's kind of keeping his head on Mars' head, to keep him down. We're going to see that clearly with Patrick Claiborne and the Confederacy. So again, I've told you this before, I'll say it again. The Irish were treated very badly here by in the United States, in the city I grew up in here, which is very heavily Irish. When you look at the history back in the day, after the potato famine, 1850s, it was not well. But again, people take pride in it. I mean, Boston is a very Irish city. Yeah. And they take pride in it, as is New York City, as is parts of Philadelphia, even Chicago, sort of. But,
dying its river green.
I guess what it is. Anyway, so let's drop it up here. So Patrick Claiborne's coming up for us next. So some things coming for us. We're going to have our YouTube live tomorrow, Saturday, which is exactly what it is, tomorrow. And then we're going to be doing the episode on Claiborne. We got the book club. We're going to be announcing that here soon with some updates for that. We're going to be doing that. And we have a lot of other stuff coming for us. So, all right. So any final words from you, you Canadian leprechaun?
Well, thanks for bringing it like you always do with this. I learned a lot from you in this episode. So thank you for that. Thank you to our listeners for supporting us for these last 124 episodes. We are on to 125, where we will talk about General Patrick Claiborne.
And remember, a city like Boston, it just tells you that the Boston College team is the real Fighting Irish. I'll tell you that right
now.
Father
Corby would disagree with you.
Father Corby's a BC reject. Anyway, off we go. Guys, have a great weekend. Have a safe weekend. We'll hopefully see you on our YouTube Live. St. Paddy's Day is still a few days away, so we'll have our Guinness then. But again, we will talk to you all soon. Mary, the pleasure, as always, is all yours. And we will talk to you all on the other side. Have a great weekend, everybody.
See y'all later.